And today we have Patrick Lee, who's going to give the first talk. He gave a colloquium yesterday on Mariner fermions. Today he's giving us a review on quantum spin liquid, the life after the droth. And this afternoon, after lunch, Paul Chaikin will give us a talk on something a bit more exotic about interfaces and surfaces and so on. Please let me welcome Patrick Lee for his first talk.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here in this wonderful institute. And I didn't realize that there can be anything more exotic than quantum spin liquid. So I look forward to hearing it this afternoon. So it's one of my favorite topics nowadays, and so I'd like to give you a kind of a overview of what's been going on in this story. Over the years, I've worked with many people. Sento Nagos, Xiaogang Wen, who's going to be showing up here very soon, and students and postdocs. So what I would like to do, I better stand back here. I want to introduce the what is quantum magnetism and spin liquid, and emphasize the idea. This is a prime example of what a lot of people talk about nowadays, this emergence, namely totally new physics emerges at low energy, at low temperature, out of what you might have considered as relatively simple structure. In this case, a simple structure is a spin, Hamiltonian with a spin, and what emerges at low temperature are new particles like spinons and even gauge fields. Or at least we expect them to emerge. We haven't seen them yet. After being many years in the wilderness doing theory, the last 10 years or so, there actually have been experimental systems, and I want to discuss a few of them. The organic compound is probably the best studied. And then I will ask the question. I believe that this part of the story had the spinons. Probably, I think there's good evidence that people have seen spinons. Then I think the remaining question is that is there any sign of the gauge field? Is there any experiment we can do to see the gauge field? And I will also mention a bit about the Kagome, and this whole subject is closely related to superconductivity. And in fact, is how it got started or reignited. Of course, conventional magnetism, anti-ferromagnetism, was proposed theoretically by Nail. So we have local moments which are ordered anti-ferromagnetically. And this local moment, the origin of the local moment is strong correlation. And we learned that, one example is the high-temperature superconductors, lanthanum cuprate, where we should morally have metal according to band theory, but Mott tells us that these local spins get localized because of strong correlation. But the corollary is that the anti-parallel spin can virtually hop and gain an exchange energy for T squared over U, and that's responsible for the fundamental anti-ferromagnetism in these local moment systems. And of course the high TC problem is the one where we dope the Mott insulator with holes, and somehow, mysteriously, superconductivity emerges. So, in the early days of strong correlation physics, there was a kind of a debate between Mott and Slater in the following way. So Slater would come at it from the band theory point of view. So from the point of view of band theory, then, as I said before, if you have one electron per unit cell, then there's no way of getting an insulator. But if it becomes an anti-ferromagnet, then the anti-ferromagnet, I think this guy is dying. We need a new battery. The anti-ferromagnet, if you have an anti-ferromagnetic ground state, of course that doubles the unit cell. The unit cell is doubled. Then you have two electrons per unit cell, right? Once you have that, then you can have insulator. And then everything, the man who travels with his own lighter. I'll have two guns. Well, this is also falling apart. Okay, so, right. So once you allow the fact that the ground state is an anti-ferromagnet, then, well, that actually works. Yeah, so let me keep that for now.
Well, maybe, this won't work. But.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, right. Yeah. So according to Slater, then you know there's no problem because the unit cell is doubled, and then you can have a kind of conventional band insulator. Okay. Now, however, Mott says that well, this doesn't really make much sense because the charge gap that he has is really due to strong correlation, and it's not just due to antiferromagnet, which is the driving force for the antiferromagnet is only J, is much less than the fundamental correlation energy U, right? So the antiferromagnetism is actually really secondary. And therefore, in Mott's picture, the Mott insulator really is a violation of band theory. And this is just a band-aid, and it just fixes it. Okay, well, I think to settle this question, one idea, one direction is that to ask, can we have a Mott insulator that doesn't have antiferromagnetic order, right? If we find such an object, then we would say that, well, Mott's really is correct, that this being antiferromagnetic doesn't have to be is not the driving force for having these Mott insulators, right? So that's one motivation to ask this question, right? Well, that question was really asked seriously in 1973 by Phil Anderson, who introduced the idea of a resonating valence bond in those days. And the key idea is that if you take two spins, if you form a spin singlet, you can, in principle, gain a lot of energy. And you can do better than antiferromagnetic order. And so this argument is actually special to spin a half system. So a simple example is let's consider one-dimensional spin chain. And the naive picture is that Naill state would be just up, down, up, down, up, down. But we can try a very simple trial wave function, which just consider of singlet. We just dimerize them into singlets. So a singlet is, of course, just up, down, minus down, up. So we just draw this. But you can see that the singlet energy per bond is S plus 1 times J. Now, 1 is quantum mechanics. So I put it in red, right? So now you can see that S equals 1 half is where you can enjoy this quantum energy the most, okay? And therefore, in this case, per bond, you get 3/8 of J. Whereas if you are Naill, you just do up, down, up, down, you only get 1/4 J, right? Because it's spin a half, okay? So in this case, even this very simple trial wave function wins. So this is called a valence bond solid because we dimerize and double the unit cell. But what Anderson says that if you start with this, we can make linear superposition of all these dimers, and then we can get even better energy, right? So that's what the valence resonating part comes in. And resonating just, he borrowed this from Pauling and just say that this is like the analog of superposition of many, many of these things. So that's the idea behind the RVP picture. And, right, so the definition of a spin liquid is a system where we have fundamental antiferromagnetic interaction, but the Naill order is destroyed due to quantum fluctuation. By forming a singlet, we can think of it as a way of making quantum fluctuations. So in 73, Anderson originally proposed it for a triangular lattice, and a Heisenberg model on triangular lattice may be an example of this so-called RVB state. The reason he picked the triangular lattice is that it's a frustrated lattice, right? Because if this frustration means that if this guy wants to point up, this guy wants to point down, then this guy is lost. He doesn't know which way to point, okay? So obviously, to beat Naill, it's good to look for these frustrated lattices. Unfortunately, his idea didn't work for the triangular lattice. It was soon pointed out that the spins can compromise and make what is called 120 degree order, right? So because it's Heisenberg spin, it doesn't have to be just up and down. If the spins all point 120 degrees to each other, they can still enjoy a little bit of the antiferromagnetism. And then that turns out to be the correct ground state. So then this subject kind of went into hiatus for many years and was revived only in the context when HITC was discovered and Anderson has the idea that if you start with a spin liquid and you manage to dope it, then you can get a high temperature superconductor. And that proposal got people excited and go back and think about these spin liquid state once again. So the idea of the doping is very simple. Okay, so meanwhile, a lot of people have been working, theorists have been working very hard on this subject. And study what are the properties of the spin liquid if it exists. Okay, so far we haven't found a Hamiltonian where it exists, but doesn't stop theorists from asking questions. Suppose we have this state, what would it do? So I think the consensus is that this state would be very, very interesting if it exists. Okay, it's not, it's much more than just saying that there's no order. Because in order not to have order, something else has to happen. And then this is the whole idea, notion of emergence. So a lot of theorists believe that new excitations will show up. An example would be a spin and a half particles, which are called spinons, because in an ordinary antiferromagnet, the excitations are spin one magnons, right? You take a spin and flip it, that will be a spin one excitation. And however, in a RVB state, the more one possible way is that these spin one particle actually so-called fractionalize, separate into two spin and a half object. And then these spinons may be fermions or bosons. We don't know, they could be anions. And if they are fermions, they can even form Fermi C, so that's very exotic. And it's also believed that associated with these spinons cannot live by themselves because they are an emergent object. They're always surrounded by some gauge field. And this gauge field can be U1 gauge field, Z2, and so on and so forth. And my colleague, Xiaogan Wan, had made a lot of contribution to this area and pointed out the importance that there is a topological order behind these exotic states. Okay. So it's relatively easy to understand the idea or give a physical picture of this, how this spin a half object emerged, because these in this cartoon picture, the valence bonds are made up of spin singlet. And so an excitation would be one where I excite one of the singlet by flipping the spin, let's say, so I can go from a singlet to triplet excitation, right? And because these sides are linear superposition of many, many singlets, it's not static as I've drawn it, then these once I break a bond, then these spin and a half objects can move apart and separate from each other, right? And once they are separated, then they become two separate spin half excitation. So this is how you can break up a spin one into two spin half excitation. And once you have this picture, then you can imagine doping it. And doping is means that I remove some electrons, physical electrons from the system. It's a process of doping. Well, but now if I have these objects, these are physical electrons. They have spin and half and they can have a charge behind it. So by doping, I simply remove them and that leaves behind some holes. And these holes then becomes mobile because previously everybody's stuck in place. There's no place to move, but once I have holes, it becomes mobile. And this should at least become a metal. But in fact, if you look at it more carefully, this really looks like a soup of Cooper pairs, right? If these think of these as Cooper pairs, which are now mobile, right? So this looks like a high density of Cooper pairs, which is a superconductor. Yeah. I'll get to it later. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So that's the story. I think it's a beautiful story. And of course, a lot of us have tried hard to see if this actually works for high TC superconductors, right? A high TC superconductor is a problem which has the world's simplest Hamiltonian, but the most complicated phenomenology. And so that has been a 25-year struggle. And a lot of us have still been struggling. So meanwhile, you know, a lot of us think that this is a simpler problem because it doesn't involve holes, right? If we just stick to the spin liquid problem, at least have less degrees of freedom, maybe we have a chance of making a crack in this problem. Okay, so there's a lot of theory going on. But for a long time, we don't have any experiment. We don't have any example, physical example, except other than dimension one. In one dimension, you have spin charge separation, but that's a quite different mechanism. And so that's the very sad situation for a lot of us. In fact, about 10 years ago in Aspen, I talked about this, and afterwards my very good friend Elihu Abrahams came and talked to me and said that, you know, this field is very strange. It's looking like string theory. And you know, for a solid state physicist, that's the ultimate insult. I can say this in this building. But so that's the sad situation that we were in. Fortunately, about 10 years ago, we started getting examples, and now there are actually a number of examples in spin liquid in higher dimensions. So as a solid state physicist, I can walk around with my head held high once again. And so this is a very exciting period, I think, for us, because you know, once you experiment, then you can ask all kinds of questions and you know, and see. And so one of my emphasis, my research direction in recent years is actually to ask, raise a question: what kind of experiment can we do on these spin liquid candidates to search for these emergent particles? Right? Can we actually see the spin on? Can we see the gauge fields? And so on. And, so my hope is that there will be more experimental progress. And, the theory is actually, you know, a fundamental theory is quite well developed. Okay. Yeah, so part of my sermon. For high TC problems, the ground state are conventional, and the spin liquid is kind of hiding. If it's there, it's hiding at high temperature. So it's very difficult to make precise statement. And if you have a spin liquid ground state, you know, I think you can grab, you know, you can grab onto this ground state and really ask what is the true excitation of this system. So what are the requirements? We want an insulator, right? Ideally, we want odd number of electron per unit cell, and it should be essentially Mott's idea that there's a Mott insulator that doesn't order antiferromagnetically. Okay, so let me take a few slides to review the theory before I go into the experiment. Okay, so we can start with a relatively simple starting point of just Heisenberg-Hamiltonian exchange, and put this on a imagine putting this on some frustrated model like a Kagome lattice. And how to proceed, right? So one way that we like to proceed is to introduce fermions which carry spin indices. Right? I can always represent a spin operator by fermions. F, and it turns out that the S dot S can be written in terms of these fermion operators. I think this was first written down, as far as I know, in Bascrans' paper. But is that true? But maybe early. But at least I learned it from Bascrans' paper. So that's right. And now, the problem is that there's a constraint on this, and that because by introducing fermions, I've enlarged my Hilbert space, right? And so I have to restrict myself that there's only, on each side, there can be only one fermion. So the total number of fermions up and down has to be one. I cannot allow empty sites. There will be the whole doping. And I cannot allow double. Right? There will be the doublon. Okay. So the entire problem has to do with enforcing this constraint. So no charge fluctuation is allowed. So there are two ways to proceed. One is numerical. We can use a projected wave function. And so you can do your mean field theory and come up with your best mean field trial wave function. And then on a computer, you can by hand do a projection, which throws out all the states that is out of your Hilbert space, all the doubly occupied, any state component that has doubly occupation, we just throw it out. And then this will be a projected wave function. So this will be a genuine spin wave function, that even though we started out with a fermionic, like a tight binding, hopping, or wave function. Okay. And So this turns out to be quite useful numerical method. Nowadays, there are even more sophisticated methods like using tensor products and so on. But this is one direction. And the other direction is more analytic, and it always ends up with some kind of gauge theory. Right? So that's why I want to explain this, how this gauge theory emerges out of this. And And gauge theory emerges generally because we have a many-to-one representation. Our representation is we have artificially brought in too many states. And when we try to go back to it's a many-to-one mapping. And when you do that, then you find that you always have some kind of gauge theory. And in this case, the way I'll show you how it works in a minute. So why fermions? With the same spin, you can represent it in many different ways. You can also represent it with bosons, right? When I do this, this guy, this can be a boson, right? If I do that, that's called a Schringer boson representation, and that actually predated these fermion representation. So why do we use bosons? First of all, you can use boson, and then you can also work out mean field theory. The thing is that bosons like to condense, and if they condense, then we can get Nail order. The condensed version of boson is Nail order. And if they don't condense, then typically we get a gap state, because a boson actually can only have two choices. It's either the spectrum is either gapped or it condenses. It's hard to get anything in between. So I would say that generally boson is better for describing the order state or gap spin liquid. Okay. Whereas the fermion representation is better to describe this gapless spin liquid. Okay. And so in principle, either formulation is exact, but of course we make approximation. So the question is, which mean field theory is closer to the truth? A priori, we don't know at this point. We don't know which one is a better theory. And that's why we need experiment. Okay. If we have experiments, then we can have an idea which one is closer to the truth. And as you see, the experiments that we have so far, these spin liquids appear to be gapless, all the examples that I have. And therefore, it's better to proceed with a fermionic representation. Okay, so. Yeah. So now, as I said, Bhaskaran taught us to write the S dot S in terms of four fermions. And when you see four fermions, your natural instinct is to decouple them in mean field theory. So we can decouple them. And there are two channels that you can decouple. Either the hopping term, F dagger F, between two different sites, or a pairing term for two different sites. If you want to be fancy, you can write it the partition function as some kind of a path integral involving these, think of these as dynamical variables, right? And the mean field is the saddle point of this dynamical variable, okay? But now notice what happens, that if I decouple this in this hopping channel, then the mean field Hamiltonian is one where we have fermions and lattice, and they're just hopping around with this chi ij, and they may have some pairing. But let's focus on the hopping term first. So these fermions are hopping, and the hopping is driven by this chi ij, which itself a complex object, is a dynamical variable. So this in general has an amplitude and a phase, and the phase on the link chi ij, it becomes a gauge field, right? Because you know that if you, for example, if you have a magnetic field and you want to formulate that tight binding or hopping of electron in a magnetic field, all you have to do is to make the hopping matrix tournament complex in such a way that if I hop around a square, I enclose a finite flux. So similarly here, these things are naturally complex, so they will naturally have magnetic field. So if I hop around and the total phase enclosed in a flux would give me a magnetic field. So at this stage, the problem becomes a problem of the so-called compact U1 gauge field, because these are compact in the sense that they are complex object defined on the lattice on the link coupled to fermions. Okay, and so that's where the notion of emergence comes from. And the mean field solution, you can have a variety of mean field solution. If the mean field, I emphasize the mean field, were real, then the chi ij's are real, and then you naturally get a Fermi C, because I just have electrons which are half filled, one electron, one fermion per site, hopping around in some tight binding lattice, then I just have a Fermi C. If this chi ij are complex, then I could have some kind of a Dirac C. That's one possibility. Or we can have some pairing. If we start with this chi ij, Fermi C, I can now impose some pairing, and I can have some kind of pairing of the spinons. Now, these spinons and gauge field are, looks like the way I formulated it is a mathematical construct, right? It's just something I pull out of the hat. And you would say that, you know, they're obviously not real, they're a fictitious object. However, it is possible to end up in a so-called, you know, in this kind of gauge theory, you can be in a confined phase or in a deconfined phase. In a deconfined phase, then the fermion and gauge field would emerge as new particles on their own right at low energy. And this is the notion of fractionalization. Okay. So the bottom line is that these objects, which are fictitious, that are introduced, have a chance of emerging at low temperature they take a life of its own. They become real somehow. Okay. And that's the exotic property of these objects, that they're exotic, that there are these excitations. They're not there in the beginning, but they emerge as really real particles. So this is the essence of the spin liquid, and that's what makes it so exciting. Right. And so there are many versions of this possibility. There's Z2 gauge theories, and actually they are exactly soluble models due to Kitaev and Wen. These generally have a finite energy gap. Or we can leave the, in this formulation, they would correspond to some fermion pairing. If there's no pairing, then we have U1 gauge theory, and then we can have either Dirac C, Fermi C, or some kind of Dirac spinon C. Now, nowadays, we solid state physicists are quite familiar with these, you know, from graphene. So actually, we have emergent kind of graphene physics. And so formally, various people have shown that this scenario is actually possible. Hermione have shown that deconfinement is possible if the number of Dirac species is large enough. And Sung-Sik Lee here has shown that the U1 gauge theory for the Fermi C is always deconfined. So, and the reason is that there's so many low-lying fermionic degrees of freedom that actually favors deconfinement. Okay, so I think, So the story then becomes, if it's deconfined, then the compactness of these gauge fields is not important, and so this problem really becomes a problem of non-compact gauge field coupled with Fermi surface. And this problem actually formally is identical to the world that we live in, where electrons are coupled to non-compact gauge field. So the world that we live in, the electromagnetic field, if you believe in lattice QED, also can have a confined phase and deconfined phase. And we happen to live in a world correspond to a deconfined phase of this of the QED. So once I get to this point, everything is actually totally analogous to the world that we live in. So you may ask yourself, okay, the spinons are artificial objects. They're not gauge invariant. There's a, you know, if I take this fermion and change this phase locally, then I can change then the Green's function, the fermion Green's function changes. So the fermion Green's function is not gauge invariant. So that means that these objects are not real. Right? How can I say that it's real? But I would insist that in the world that we live in, electrons are also not real. Right? Electrons have the same problem, because if you write down electron wave function, a Green's function, the electron has a local gauge symmetry. I can make a local gauge transformation on the phase. And so the electron Green's function is not real. And in the world that we live in, electrons are always coupled to a gauge field, which in this case is the electromagnetic gauge field. They always have to be hand in hand. And so I would argue that the spinons that we uncover in this spin liquid is as real as the electrons in our world. Okay, that takes a little getting used to. But it's true, I maintain. Okay, and the reason why we didn't notice that the electrons are not real in our world is because the coupling, the fine structure constant is 1 over 137. Right? The electrons are relatively weakly coupled to the gauge field. And so for most practical purposes, we can forget about the gauge field. Think of it, even though it's always fluctuating, say that it's not, you know, it's really not there, let's not worry about it. And until I apply an average gauge field, which is the electric field or magnetic field, then I worry about it, right? So the constantly fluctuating electromagnetic background is neglected. And so we pretend that the electrons are real, okay? But they're not real. Now, the world that the spin on live in is exactly analogous, except that the fine structure constant is of order one, okay? So now it becomes harder to ignore the existence of electromagnetic field. Okay, so I just invite you to imagine we live in a world where the fine structure constant is 1 and not 137. Right? Such a world presumably exists somewhere, right? Somewhere else. And people living in that world will look very different from the people. They're not called people there. Anyway, they will be very different. They'll be more quantum mechanical than people in this world. But, nevertheless, they're real. They can even be intelligent. So this is the world that we want to probe, right? And as I said, I want to emphasize that these are not as real, less real or unreal than electrons, okay? And, so in this world, the speed of light is not given by the speed of light, but it's given by J, right? The exchange constant. Because the dynamics is all controlled. I have only one energy scale, the exchange energy. So the velocity of light is given by J. The spin-on velocity is also given by J.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you argument that the real electrons are not real. So is it related to the fact that one sits down and starts to do radiative correction, and they blow up in our phase and discover that these electrons are not real?
No, it's even more elementary than that. It's just a question of gauge invariance. Can you write down a Green's function, right? Is the electron Green's function a physical object? The answer is obviously no, because I can make a local gauge transformation. I can make it zero by making it can be anything, the Green's function. So I cannot define, it's not, unless I fix a gauge, right? So I guess another way of saying it is that in the world that we live in, it's profitable for us to work in a fixed gauge, pretend that we have a fixed gauge. But that's morally not correct, right? Because the gauge field is constantly fluctuating. I cannot just will it away, right? So we basically ignore that the gauge field is there, and it's zero approximation. And we imagine that we can fix a gauge in such a way that there's no fluctuating electromagnetic field. But in this case, the fluctuation is always there. So as you see, it actually has a serious effect on these fermions. All right. Okay, so one of the important physical consequences is that if I have a Fermi liquid, if I have a Fermi C made up of these fermions, naively you would expect that the specific heat would go linear in temperature, right? If any Fermi C would have a linear specific heat. But in this theory, because of the constant fluctuation with the coupling with the background, it goes like T to the 2/3. Because it's coupling to the background. In fact, this phenomenon was already discovered for physical electron. It was first discovered by physical electron by Pincus, Holstein, and somebody else in the 70s. Before this. So they realized that the electrons are not real. And they realized that if you calculate the specific heat for an electron, three-dimensional electron, because of the coupling to the fluctuating magnetic field, then they found a T log T, that the specific heat of physical Fermis of metals should really be T log T. It's not T. The T is incorrect. Okay. Now, but the coefficient is extremely small, so no one has ever been able to measure that coefficient. Okay. But that was actually first discovered by these people for physical electron. And the reason you focus on magnetic fluctuation is that electrons coupled to fluctuating charge and fluctuating electric field and fluctuating magnetic field. Electric field can always be screened. We know the screening, right? And therefore they're relatively harmless. But magnetic field cannot be screened because current cannot be screened, and therefore fluctuating current is what these guys looked at many years ago. And shown that it has this T log T correction. So we just, this was rediscovered many times afterwards, and in two dimension, not surprisingly, these effects are even stronger. And it turns out to go as t to the 2/3 power. That's the prediction. Now, this is a prediction for two-dimensional Fermi C coupled to two-dimensional gauge field. In our world, at least I don't know how to realize two-dimensional electromagnetic field. If you have some ideas, let me know. So in this case, the gauge field are living also in the plane. Okay. Of course, in the world, we have two-dimensional electrons, but they always interact by a three-dimensional gauge field. So in the world that we live in, there's no way of achieving this. But in principle, in a spin liquid, we have a way of achieving this. Yeah? Yeah, I don't think that metallic gate would create a, because the magnetic field fluctuation would still be three-dimensional. Yeah, mu metal, I don't know. Yeah. Superconductor, maybe. Surrounded by superconductor. But still, yeah, I think for some reason, I thought about this at one point, and for some reason I think it doesn't work. But anyway.
But
But
the gauge field is, this calculation,
two-dimensional, yeah. Because they live on the plane. They doesn't know anything about the rest of the world, right? This object. They emerges from a two-dimensional Hamiltonian. Right? So they don't know anything about outside space. Yeah. Okay, so what is the physical meaning of this gauge field? This is an answer to your question. It's really related to this. So the physical quantity is related to is this quantity called spin chirality. So the idea is that if I take an incident snapshot of the spin configuration, then the spins will be pointing in some direction. If I take three of them, then they will subtend a solid angle on the sphere. So this solid angle is given by this chirality. S, right? It's a volume subtended by this free spin, S1 dot S2 cross S3. Okay? And so if you take a fermion and hop, if you have this spin configuration, if you take a fermion and hop it around this plaquette, then you see that your spin's quantization axis is changing, right? So therefore, you would pick up a Barry's phase as you hop around, because you're hopping, the spin hopping preserves spin, right? Spin is not changed, but your quantization axis is changing, right? So therefore, when you hop around, you would pick up this Barry's phase, and this Barry's phase is. And this is the reason why in this effective hopping model for spin-ons is complex. When I hop around, I can pick up a phase. And that phase is related to this spin chirality. Okay. Now, how do you measure spin chirality? I don't know. We have some ideas, but I may not talk about here. Okay. Directly, that is. Okay, so that is a physical analog of the magnetic gauge field. So again, we focus on the magnetic part of the fluctuation. Another reason is that, you know, in this case, because fine structure constant is order one, the magnetic fluctuation is the same strength as the electric one. So there's no reason to ignore them. There's no small parameter V over C, because Fermi velocity is the same as the speed of light. Okay, so that's the theory background, and now I can go to the examples. The first one that came into prominence is a class of organic system. They form a triangle lattice, and the important thing is that these objects live near the Mott transition, and that's what enabled the spin liquid to survive. So for this system, I'm lying a little bit, right? Because I started out with a pure spin Heisenberg model. Okay, and we know that on a triangular lattice, the Heisenberg model doesn't form a spin liquid, and but these guys happen to be near a Mott transition, so morally they're still a insulator, okay, but the spin Hamiltonian is presumably rather complicated, okay, so they cannot be described by a Heisenberg model. We don't know the Hamiltonian, but it seems to show a nice ground state, okay, so we'll take that, okay. Another class is the Kakome lattice. The Kakome is even more frustrated than a triangular lattice. In this case, it is a genuine spin model. Okay. Again, but there's some complication about a Hamiltonian. There's a class that's not too well studied called hyperKakome, three dimension. And recently, there have been some new experiments on this compound, which is again a triangular lattice. And there's a spin a half version and a spin one version. they both claim to be spin liquid in the sense that I would describe. Okay. Now, there are other disordered ground state, the pyro cores, which is the physics is a bit different. There is a competition between single ion anisotropy and exchange, and I think the next talk will go into that. And here I'm mainly talking about spin the half, where there's no single ion anisotropy. So the physics is quite different. And I want to emphasize that I'm not talking about spin glass or spin ice and these things, which tend to be classical. For example, spin glass is where you freeze into a whole variety of different ground state. But we have quantum mechanical case, we freeze into the ground state is a unique ground state, or maybe a few degeneracy, but it's not like we have many ground states. So the absence of order is not because we cannot find a ground state. We have truly found a quantum mechanical ground state, which is very exotic. Okay, so let me go into the examples. The first was studied mainly by Kanoda's group in Tokyo, and let me abbreviate it by calling these ET molecules. They are molecules that stack like this. They have layered materials. These ET molecules from layers separated by this anion, which I can substitute. They can many versions. And the physical property changes by changing this substitution. And it turns out that these things form in pairs, so we should really think of this as a molecule of the ET2. The molecule forms a, if you look from the top, they form almost a triangular lattice. And each one actually carries a spin a half if you count the charge doping. So this is a prototypical example of a Mott insulator. We kind of insulator to metal transition. So we think we can describe this as a Hubbard model on a triangular lattice. The triangular lattice is not perfect, but by tuning these X substitution, the experimentalists think they can control the ratio of T prime to T. And when this is almost isotropic is where the spin liquid shows up. So this is the, so this is a famous phase diagram. With no pressure, nothing happens. For us, nothing happens is good. Right? If it's boring, it's good, because we don't want any. So it's an insulator, but there's no order. And so this is a resistance as a function of pressure. So this is a convincer that these are really insulator. Right? In ambient pressure, the resistance changes by five orders of magnitude, from room temperature to 30 Kelvin. Right? So these are genuine insulators. Under pressure, it becomes a metallic eventually, but very nicely in between, it becomes a superconductor first. Okay, and the superconductor on temperature is about 3.5 Kelvin. And then and here's a, looks like a metallic state. But the point is that there's no insulator, no antiferromagnet. In contrast, if the ratio anisotropy is not close to one, then this is more traditional behavior. We have a paramagnetic insulator going into an antiferromagnetic insulator ground state. Okay, under pressure, again, you become superconductor. And in fact, this is the world's, this is the highest transition temperature for an organic material, 12 degrees it was achieved here. Okay. Now, so the thing that got us excited in the beginning are the measurements of spin susceptibility and specific heat. The spin susceptibility is a function of temperature and it's doing this. But the important thing is that it goes to a constant. It doesn't go to zero, and there's no activation behavior. So the spin susceptibility goes to a constant at low temperature. But even more remarkably, the specific heat gamma, if you do the traditional plot of C over T versus T squared, there's a finite intercept, okay, which means that this has a linear specific heat gamma with a quite large number, which is 15 millijoule per Kelvin square. So this is almost a heavy fermion in that language. It's an intermediate weight fermion. And remarkably, if you take the ratio of this susceptibility of the to the gamma, this so-called Wilson ratio is basically one, which is what is appropriate for free fermions. So as you know, we usually associate a linear specific heat to a Fermi surface, right? And this finite susceptibility is the Pauli susceptibility of a Fermi surface. But let me remind you that this is an insulator, right? So what is it doing behaving like a metal, right? So this is an insulator that pretends to be a metal. So that's, I think, is very spectacular. And of course, the first interpretation would be that this is because there's a Fermi C, or some residual part of a Fermi C the spin-on emerging in form of Fermi C. So that's the interpretation that we like to have. Now, let me just point out that something happens at 6 degrees. Those of you with good eyes can already see that there's a kink in the specific curve. When they subtract some smooth background, they obtain some peak in the specific. So this looks to me, with lover's eyes, looks like a BCS transition. Can we have partially gapped Fermi surface due to pairing or something like that? But it's something I'd like to come back to a little later. Okay, so that's the first example. Then in the last four or five years ago, more examples have been discovered at different molecule, which we abbreviate as DMIT. But everything else is very similar. It's a stacking, the same kind of stacking. And again, the spin susceptibility looks very, very similar. It comes to, there's a kind of a peak, and then it comes to a constant. By the way, this fits rather well with a triangle lattice Heisenberg model with an exchange of 200 Kelvin. So the fundamental scale, exchange scale, is like 200 Kelvin. Nevertheless, down to 20 millikelvin, there's no sign of any ordering. And the evidence for that is the NMR, right? So the line doesn't split, doesn't show anything down to 20 millikelvin. Okay, so there's no evidence of any ordering, which would split the NMR line. Initially, this susceptibility was measured only down to 1 or 2 Kelvin. At a March meeting, Matsuda's group reported a recent measurement using a torque magnetometer, which is very accurate, which goes down to 30 millikelvin. And they showed that this spin susceptibility remained constant down to at very low temperature. Because you might have been a little bit nervous. Oops. Looking at this, you know, is it kind of plunging down? Maybe I got my zero wrong. But no, so this thing is really going to a constant. And it's like this. By the way, this thing has been taken to 30 Tesla, very large field. And that doesn't seem to be any phase transition as a function of field either. So this is, right, there's no sudden jump, which may have some bearing to some of my speculations later. Okay, so that's the, so let me just summarize original ET material and the cap. Oh, this is ET and this is the DMIT. A linear specific heat, quite comparable. Gamma is 15, 20, and 24, so on. Now, 3 years ago, Yamashita, 2 years ago, also measured the thermal conductivity. So the question is that, you know, suppose we have this low-lying object, are they localized? Are they just, are they mobile, right? So these guys are, of course, charge neutral. We don't have any charge excitation. But they can carry heat because they carry entropy, right? They have a spin degrees of freedom. They're real objects. So they should contribute to thermal conductivity, just like a metal. In a metal, the thermal conductivity, kappa over T, goes to a constant, right? And they carried out this experiment, indeed, down to very low temperature. Indeed, this extrapolated to a constant. Okay, and you can convert this with a specific heat formula to get a mean free path, and you get about 500 lattice constants. So these spin-ons are very well delocalized. They can travel almost freely. Okay, on the other hand, the original ET salt seems to develop a small gap below 0.2 Kelvin. And so this is the data, actually. This is the MIT salt. And the ET salt is similar here. But you see, below here, which is about 0.2 Kelvin, it seems to go down a little bit. So if you extrapolate, you can get a finer value. So this has been a longstanding controversy, whether there's a difference between these two materials or whether there's some something different with the measurement. These two measurements are made by the same person, so I cannot accuse them of somehow being wrong, but it is very striking. Yeah. Yeah, I'll explain in a minute. Maybe I won't explain. First of all, these things are charge neutral, right? So they don't see an external field. So the first answer is no. Right? But the second answer is yes, because they see a gauge field. And if you apply external magnetic field, that external magnetic field can induce a gauge field. And that gauge field can, in principle, give rise to quantum oscillation. Okay. And then, but the third answer is no. So Motronich looked at this and he says that the energetics is such that if you try to do a conventional quantum oscillation experiment, these things break up into what is called quantum domains. Okay, in other words, the density is not uniform. You can make and then you won't see quantum oscillations. Yeah, so depending on how hard you think, it's either yes or no. So I think if I were an experimentalist, I would ignore all these theories and just try it. So in principle, that would be very nice. You might be able to see quantum oscillation in the thermal conductivity, for example. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but there are many issues like that that will be interesting. Yeah. Okay, so here's my favorite plot. Oh, I dug this out of literature. So this is a thermal conductivity. I focus on the low temperature, which is, you know, either has a tiny gap or doesn't. But this is a 6-degree peak that I showed you with a specific heat. Turns out that there's a signature in the thermal conductivity. There's a little peak here in the thermal conductivity, right? This is very low temperature. And if you go to another material, the same molecules, ET, but substitution, you can make a 9-degree superconductor. And 10 years ago, Bainier looked at this, measured this thermal conductivity. And at TC, he sees a peak. Okay. So it's remarkable to me that these two samples, the thermal conductivity looks very similar. Okay, even the magnitude is the same, but in one case I have a superconductor, in this case I have an insulator. Right. The extrapolated thermal conductivity is almost also the same. You extrapolate, you get a finite thermal conductivity here to the quasi particles, and here I have a finite thermal conductivity. Okay, just some fruitful thoughts. Okay, so what is the reason that we see this spin liquid? It's because we're near a Mott transition. As I said, if I look at the phase diagram as a function of U over T in the Hubbard model, the very strong correlation limit, I should get 120 degrees phase, right? This should be the ground state. But we think we're living here, right? On the border between the metal and insulator. And there is part, then our Hamiltonian is not just Heisenberg. There can be exchange interaction and so on. And this is why we think. So several years ago, Sung Sik, when he was a postdoc with us, we showed that the low energy effective theory is indeed exactly this fermions coupled to gauge fields. So we can see that this thing, in principle, can emerge as a possible system. So this brings us back to the same effective Hamiltonian that I showed you before, starting from the exchange Hamiltonian. Okay, what about experiments? So if you look deeper in the experiment, I said that we should expect T to the 2/3, right? So now we're getting greedy, right? It's not enough to see a fermi surface. Can you see signs of the gauge field, right? So the gauge field says that we should have seen T to the 2/3, but so far the data is always linear. I should mention that there's probably not enough range to really distinguish between 2/3 and 1, but maybe there is. But there's also this magical phase transition at 6 Kelvin, which is a real transition. People see it in thermal expansion coefficient very clearly. And this peak in specific heat. And So one suggestion is that can we be seeing spin-on pairing? You know, once you have a Fermi surface, we know that most Fermi surfaces are unstable to pairing, so why don't we just pair them, right? And that might explain this kind of specific heat. And then if you pair, then this U1 gauge field breaks up into Z2 gauge field. This gauge fluctuation is suppressed. And then that may explain why we don't see T to the 2/3, because in the pair state, we would expect to get back the linear T. Suppose you have a pair state that leaves behind some residual Fermi surface. You don't wipe out the entire fermion surface. Then we would expect this. Okay, so the question is what kind of pairing? One candidate is D-wave pairing, right? And if you introduce some disorder, the node can give a finite density of state. However, I think this very recent experiment that doesn't see any change if I drive the temperature up to 30 Kelvin, which is much more than the 6 Kelvin energy scale. If I have a singlet pairing, I would expect that I would kill this pairing transition. So we need something more exotic. And actually, Sonsik and Sandu and I, several years ago, proposed something more exotic, but I don't want to get into that. So this is just summarizing some of the problems. I mean, I want to tell you that there, not everything is understood in these organic. So open issues, they're the small gaps versus no gap in thermal conductivity, and the nature of the phase transition. So I think those are the some of the remaining issues. Is there a way to see spin on Fermi surface? Recently, we with Matthew Fisher, actually, and a student at MIT, we just pointed out something very simple. In principle, you might be able to see this Fermi surface by photo emission, right? You know, photo emission usually sees a Fermi surface from a metal, right? But in this case, the electron spectrum is a convolution of a fermion and a boson of a charged boson, and it will be gapped. So the prediction is that if you do RPES, you will see a gap, but above the gap, you will start seeing a spectral function. A spectral function would increase like a square root. But in K-space, if you do so-called, then as you increase the energy, you may see a ring of spectral function, okay, if you have a Fermi surface. So in principle, we believe this may show up as as a ring structure in photo emission with a gap. In the case of the direct spectrum, for the cargo mate, I would explain, we actually predict kind of points, dots that will show up. Right? So this will be very, very exotic, of course, amazing if we see it. Santo and a student pointed out that maybe you can see Friedel oscillations due to these spin on Fermi surface that you might try with the STM. Oh, I see, that's the thing. How to see gauge fields, right? So this is the other part of the puzzle that we hadn't address. There's quantum oscillations that you already anticipated, okay? We predicted thermal Hall effect. Another thing you might think about is thermal Hall effect. For the same reason, if I apply a magnetic field, it can induce a chirality, and the spin on CZ chirality, and we have a thermal Hall effect. Thermal Hall effect is where I apply a thermal gradient in one direction, and I see a current in the opposite direction, or the other way around. Right? So they actually searched for this, and unfortunately didn't see it. One possibility to rig out of this is that maybe if these fermions are really paired, then we may actually have Meissner effect. So this this gauge field is actually excluded. Okay. The other thing is there may be in-gap optical excitations, and ultrasound attenuation is another prediction that we made recently that will be a spectacular thing, but let me skip that. So if this 6-degree transition is really a pairing transition, then if I just go back to read the old literature from the 1960s, then of course you predict that the ultrasound attenuation would have a decrease. But this is maybe something less known. For transverse ultrasound, there's this phenomenon called rapid drop. In other words, for longitudinal ultrasound, you just drop like an exponential because the gap opened up. But transverse ultrasound actually drop almost like a first order transition. The explanation for this is that transverse ultrasound is coupled to electromagnetic field because it's transverse. And once you become a superconductor, Meissner effect comes in and kill your electromagnetic field. And it's a much more sensitive signature of the transition. So it's almost first order. And this has been seen. Experimentally. So we're suggesting that people do similar experiment for this ET. If they see this, then I think this is a true, very direct signature of gauge field and of Meissner effect, because it's very hard to explain a sudden jump like this otherwise. Okay, so if anyone of you know who still know people who are doing ultrasound experiment, let me know. Yeah. Okay, Let me quickly go through the Kagome lattice. I think I'm out of time. I should go to my conclusion. Maybe I should skip it. Just a quick message is that several years ago, Nocera and Young Li discovered this material that is an ideal system. Anyway, there are caveats. We don't know the Hamiltonian. There could be Jarzynski-Maria terms. There are local moments, which 15% of the sink site are occupied by coppers. But these local moments seem to be off the plane. That's the good news. So maybe they're not so important. And theoretically, I think this is an area of very active research. The question is whether what is the ground state? I think everybody is convinced that the theoretical Heisenberg model on the Kagome lattice should be a spin liquid. The question is, what kind of spin liquid is it? Is it gapped? And what is it? Okay, so And there's a three-dimensional version of this called a hyper-Kagome. In this case, the specific heat is T square. Instead of linear T, still very striking. We don't know what it is. So very recently, there are these two more examples that was published. And we have something to say about this. Lara Thompson is a Canadian NSERC fellow that visiting it. And she came up with the idea that the spin a half system may actually be a spin liquid in disguise. It's not a real spin liquid, because in this system, there's a orbital degeneracy. The spin a half system has two orbitals. So you can have a phenomenon of orbital ordering. So the system actually can spontaneously become a spin one chain. And that can explain the data. She has some very nice fit of the data, of the spin susceptibility and the specific heat. This is the data. This is not so nice, but this fit is very nice on the specific susceptibility. So we think that example may not be so interesting. But the other example is a spin one version, which to me is a total mystery, because we don't really expect spin liquid. We expect spin one to be less quantum mechanical and for triangular lattice. And so this is, I think, very, very open. So let me, just an advertisement. Forget about this. This has to do with Zoom activity. So, yeah, so I think there's an excellent chance of this spin liquid state has been discovered experimentally. And I think there are many experimental questions, and I think there are many opportunities to do more experiments. And so I think this is a very exciting time. Thank you.